We're rolling. Today is Sunday, the 7th of April, 2019. We're already in the shadow of Pesach. Tomorrow will be the last year before Pesach. But today is a very different day. First of all, I just want to make one correction. We've been talking about Balei Tshuva, and I mentioned the problem of off the derech. And I gave a figure. I think I said they say it may be up to 20% of Lakewood. So I got a letter here, David Safier, and among other comments, that he figures the most it is in Lakewood is 5%, not 20%. And I have to clarify that I was getting my information from a website where it may be a prejudiced source. It was from Chaim Shulsin, who's a Chabadnik. And believe me, he rejoices when he can show that Chabad is triumphing over Lakewood. Okay, since we met last Monday, a lot happened. And to a certain degree, my life changed, shifted gears. I never thought I would give a shiur about my involvement in missing in action soldiers, and how a little kid from the Bronx named Donnie Rothkopf, a.k.a. Aaron Rakefet, ultimately the policy of the Israeli army was changed as a direct result of yours truly. The reason I never thought I would give a shiur on this topic is that part of what I'm touching upon, I cannot give all the details, simply the security clause that is upon me. But what happened was, with the unbelievable news last Wednesday at 3:15 in the afternoon, later that evening on Galei Tzahal, a general from the IDF started speaking about Aaron Rakefet. And I had grandsons who happened to be listening. They had friends who were listening. Other people by chance were listening. And the questions have been endless. So I promised everyone on Sunday I would give a shiur and make everything as crystal clear as I can. It's a very difficult topic for me to talk about. There's a lot of pain, but what can I say? God put me in a certain position, and the rest, as they say, is history. I spent all of Friday morning with the Baumel family, and I'm right up to date on everything that happened. Interestingly enough, the Baumels knew nothing until 3 o'clock Wednesday afternoon. Wednesday afternoon, the children, their two children, there's a son and a daughter. The daughter actually was my student in Michlala, the Israeli division, the early 70s. And the daughter and the son, the daughter lives in Yerushalayim, not far from the mother. The mother lives, the Baumels, Yonah, they lived right near Miskav Ladach, if you know what I'm about, right at the end of Katamon, right down the hill. And the son lives in Ramat Gan, and the army informed both of them to please be with their mother at 3 o'clock. They'll have something to tell them. So the kids were in Yerushalayim with their mother, and as Miriam, that's the mother of the deceased, put it, at 3 o'clock the entire army walked into her little apartment. She was in the middle of getting ready for Pesach. She knew nothing, absolutely nothing. And not only high-ranking officers from intelligence, from her son's unit, but of course a medical doctor, a psychologist, a social worker, with all their aides and assistants, and they broke the news to them. At 3:15, they broke the news on the radio. And at 3:20, my grandson called me hysterical about what's happening. We couldn't believe our ears. And the next thing we did was call Miriam Baumel, and we got the army there, and it confirmed what her grandson had just told us. 5 minutes later, a Talmud from America called. He heard the news there. Then I hear the news. So let me begin at the beginning. All of you know that Malka and I were very heavily involved in Russia. The security clause was lifted. And we've spoken about it many times. I've written about it, but you don't have to believe one word that I wrote, because the Mossad itself put out a book, B'Nativ HaDamama, which tells the whole story. In 1989, 1990, the Communist Empire started to fall. When the Communist Empire started to fall, at that point, these boys were missing in action since 1982. What's interesting about the first Lebanese war is that my unit reached Sultan Yaakob right after the battle, literally a day or two after the battle. What happens is as follows. Let me explain to you. A battle is fought, and the army stops. They're at a new front line. They now create a border. You know what I mean by a border? Tremendous tractors attached to tanks go up and down and plow the land. Now, what they have created is a path where there's nothing on the path except dirt or sand. All trees, everything is removed. You have to see these are tremendous plows. They can uproot a building. Why is that important? Every 5 minutes an army patrol goes by to see if there are any footprints. Now, right at this border is where I lectured, and that's where I got, I've often referred to it, I got the hardest question I ever got in my life. I give this lecture, following me, the choir of the chief rabbinate, of the rabbinate of the army performs. You know, you have to, these are soldiers who fought tremendous battles. They're now on guarding duty. There's no battle going on. And you have to keep their minds occupied. So I give this lecture, and Baruch Hashem, it was a nice lecture, well received. The commander of the forces, I believe he was either a Skana Lufon, a Luft Mishneger, a lieutenant colonel, or a full colonel, asked me, Kvot Harav, and this is in front of hundreds of soldiers, Mod Nenenu Meha Hatsa'ar Shelcha, אבל אני רוצה לשאול שאלה, מי יהודי יותר טוב? הבני דודים שלי בבורו פארק בברוקלין, שומרי תורה ומצוות, שומרי שבת, אבל לא גרים כאן. או יהודי כמוני שאני לא כל כך שומר שבת, אבל אני מושא את נפשי, אני כבר בצבא 20 שנה פלוס, מי יהודי יותר טוב? All right, that's where I got that question. Now, that was the battle. We didn't knew it was a terrible battle. We knew there were a lot of karbanot. We never knew the extent of the battle. Later, of course, we learned that 20 boys, lo aleinu, were killed. Later, rumors and then military censorship couldn't stop it from being published. It was a tremendous fashla on the part of our commanders. The intelligence was on Ehud Barak's desk. He was the commander of the Northern Front, and somehow he didn't see it, the people under him didn't see it, and the tanks went into a trap where they were just mauled apart by anti-tank fire. 20 boys were killed. The worst part was that when they came back, 3 boys were missing. Now, you all know the names. The names, Zach Baumel, with him in the same tank was the Feldman boy, and then you had in a separate tank the Katz boy. And these boys are missing. And Yona Baumel, the father of Zach, stopped all his activities. This is his son. This is an American family. They came in Aliyah a year after we did, 1970. And these are people who are like us. It's part of the Anglo crowd that came to Israel. And he went international searching, hunching, holding on to any reference, any concept where these boys are. I need not tell you charlatans got involved. It's a very sad story. I'll give you some details in a moment what these people went through. My middle daughter, and by the way, my wife and yours truly, our work, our Mesirat Nefesh in Russia, had a big impact on all three of our daughters. All three of our daughters did volunteer work that continues until today on many different levels as a result of their parents' influence. Again, you don't do it to influence children, but what you do, willy-nilly, has an impact on them. So my middle daughter, Rhea Eisen, happened to attend a demonstration outside the Knesset for these boys missing in action. It was about 85, 86, and she met the Baumels, and she got involved, and ultimately they organized the ICMIS, International Committee for the Missing Israeli Soldiers, ICMIS, ICMIS. And they started propaganda, I'll use the word, publishing, talking with Chavrei Knesset, talking with people in America, senators. I need not go into more detail. You understand yourself. They wanted to solve the dilemma, where are the boys? When my involvement in Russia ended, and remember, by 1990, 1991, they didn't need Rakefet anymore. If Yomo was around at that time, they could send Yomo back to Russia. All you needed was an Israeli passport. So they didn't need us, thank God. We did our share. The Americans were now out of it. Russian speakers started going over. And my daughter says to me, Abba, your Russian activities have ended. Help us out. And I got involved. At first, I spoke at fundraising events that took money to support this. But then I became very close to Yonah Baumel. And my heart went out to him. And I got involved full-time plus. Every Friday, we would sit in a cafe, which later becomes Sabaro, where the great tragedy takes place. Or this was after Sabaro. I can't even put the time together. It could be it was after Sabaro. We would sit in that corner cafe, and we'd go through the latest intelligence, the latest intelligence. Now, there's one more name I have to mention. I mentioned the name in the House of Mourning on Friday, and Miriam wanted to hug me. She was so happy I recalled, and we both spoke about this person. And for us, why you people, it's a very important name. Mike Kaplan, Mayor Kaplan. If you don't recognize the name, make believe you do, so the ignorant Elliot will pass for the wise. Who are we talking about? Mike Kaplan, his years 1923-2004. Mike or Mayor Kaplan, these are among the greatest people I ever met in my life. These are the people that built Israel. Mike was born in Brooklyn. Where does he tie into YU? Gentlemen, who went to Teachers Institute, part of Yeshiva and Yeshiva College, the 1920s, the 1930s, no, is anyone sitting here from that era? Who was the head of the faculty of Teachers Institute? Rabbi Dr. Yechiel Kaplan. Yitzchak, what was his doctorate? 1925, Columbia University, redaction of the Babylonian Talmud. Yitzchak, I guarantee you, if you could go to Rabbi Philip Goodman, your late father-in-law, and look at his library, you will find this book in his library. You get there. Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Rubin certifies that the Rebbe is not making it up. Thank you, thank you. Wow. If you have it, lend it to me. I want to take a good look at it, okay? I just had to do my research because everyone lists his name as Y. Kaplan. It's Yechiel Kaplan. Now, Mike was his son. And you notice Mike, 1923, he was 17 years old, 16 years old when World War II broke out. When World War II was over, he was married. And he already had a master's from Columbia. Every word I'm telling you is true. It's all here. You can get it on Wikipedia. But I know it from Mike Kaplan, and I wrote a little bit about this in Washington. He had a master's from Columbia, very bright guy, and he and his wife volunteered to help the Jewish agency. They went to France, and they taught survivors, the children who survived in France, taught them Hebrew, gave them a basic education and helped the children be prepared to go on Aliyah all these children wound up in Israel, Aliyah Bet, the illegal Aliyah, the famous Aliyah, that when under the cover, you couldn't see it, it was a big secret, but they got thousands of children into Israel. When Aliyah Bet ended and France was cleared out, they came to Israel. I can give you the exact date. They came in 1947, 48, and they went to Kibbutz Yafna. Went to Kibbutz Yafna, and they were chaverim in the kibbutz, religious Zionists, the Shomer Hadati at that time. It's basically before Bnei Akiva in America was called Shomer Hadati. And they were working in the kibbutz, but Mike was a very brilliant guy, and he joined the police force. And they saw, wait, they got a guy who knows English, knows French, has a master's from Columbia. So the police force turned to him, and he turned to them, what do you want me to study? And they said, pathology, zihui plilim. The whole division in the police force to identify dead, to identify crimes, they didn't know what to do. They're establishing a state. They asked him to go back to America and get a doctorate in the field. Well, he went back to the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA, got a doctorate, and the police force, this Mike told me, it's also in Wikipedia, the Los Angeles police force cooperated with him, and any time there was a murder, he was called to the scene with the professionals to learn what you do, how to identify. He came back to Israel, and I need not tell you, he established this division in the police force. He went on to serve for many, many decades in the police force. He reached more than 35 years. He reached the highest rank that any Shomer Shabbos Jew reached in the police force until recent times, when the head of the whole police force was a Shomer Shabbos Jew, whose father davens in the Shtiblach in Katamon. And he reached the rank of a Tatnitzav. It parallels a brigadier general in the army. That was the rank he reached. He was very helpful to the Mossad in establishing Adolf Eichmann, who he was, to be sure. He played a big role, which he later won a tremendous citation from the Israeli government, which the capture of Eichmann, to be sure we had the right man and we were not bringing an innocent man to Israel. Now, by the time I got involved, the late 1990s, Mike Kaplan was retired and he devoted all his time to helping Yonah and helping me. Now, mind you, we're working on an assumption, and Yonah was convinced of this, and this is part of the tragedy, that the boys are alive. And you have to know, I said to Mike Kaplan, Mike, tell me the truth. You're the expert. He says, Rabbi Aaron, he says to me, the boys are not alive. But we got to do everything in our power until we can convince Yonah that they're not alive. And we did absolutely everything but everything in our power. Yonah, a book will one day be written. I can tell you that the Mossad, you'll see in a minute how I know so much, that the Mossad has everything on file. A book will one day be written about this entire episode, because I don't know if you realize it's mind-boggling. If anyone doesn't believe in God after what happened on Wednesday, he's either an idiot or he has no human intelligence. Mind-boggling that we should see the coffin surrounded by officers of the Russian army. When Yitzhak and I saw these people in uniform in Russia, we shivered and turned around the corner. We were frightened out of our wits, right or wrong, Yitzhak, when we were there. And here they're standing around the coffin with an Israeli flag and a Russian flag, giving honor, in the Kremlin, giving honor to a fallen Israeli soldier. It's beyond comprehension. that his tzitzit should survive, and his sabel, his uniform that you wear in a tank, should survive. It was buried with him. Miriam told me that the army asked her, what do you want us to do with the tzitzit and his clothes? She said, bury it, buried with him. And I told the Chabadnik on Shabbos that I was at the Rebbe's funeral, the last Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe. I hope any Messianic person listening will wise up. I was at the funeral, unless you tell me the coffin was empty, and they carried out the coffin. On top of it was the Rebbe's Bekesha. And I asked later when I met some of my friends who were in with the millionaires row, I was out with the proletarians. But if you gave the Rebbe $1 million a year, you were in a special house with the... So I asked him, what was that? I don't know. They bury in Israel, the coffin is covered with an Israeli flag. They bury you not in the army, so your body is covered with a talit, right or wrong. I have so many taliyot, I'll have a big problem deciding which one to use. Oh, let it be in 120 years, we'll worry then. So I asked, why... The sixth Rebbe was buried with his Bekesha on top. So already the sixth Rebbe, it has to be a Chabad tradition, they buried the seventh Rebbe. So they buried Lo Aleinu, they buried the Korban who came back from 82. They buried him with the Talit, with the Tzitzit, Abba Kumpfis. The radio first said they found this talit. He wasn't married. It wasn't a talit. It was an Abba Kumpfis. And his jacket that you wear, the pants, it's a special suit that you wear in the tank. It was buried with him. Now, while all this was happening, time and again, people came to Yonah. It was very, very sad. From India, he gets an email or a fax at that time that this lady who can talk to the dead, she can talk to the people from the battlefield. And all she wanted was a few $100 and she'll give them the information. Then, I'll never forget, the owner consulted with me. I told him, absolutely forget about it. But this really happened. In 1995, Ibrahim Suleiman, a Syrian-American close to Syria's political leaders, I'm quoting from Washington, page 433, reported that there was information in Damascus that Zachary Baumel and Ran Arad were alive. Some years later, an Israeli Jew who lived in the Golan Heights contacted Yonah. This individual claimed that through his Golan Druze contacts, he had obtained the book which Zach had recently read. He demanded payment for this information and making the book available for scientific analysis by Israeli intelligence. Money changed hands, thousands of dollars. Tests were conducted, and the results were totally negative. These were only a few of the many such tips and suggestions that were constantly passed along to Yonah, each one of which he followed up on, analyzed, and acted upon. And we would sit Friday and go through this, and I remember how excited he was, a book, right, reading. Then there were reports, and fingerprints, what they looked for, DNA already at that time, absolutely sterile. Then there was reports from the Arab countries that people are in jail speaking Hebrew. And I got all excited. Who could this be? All right, I later learned from Mossad contacts that the Arabs lie. It's just part of their culture. Mm-hmm. That even among themselves they lie. Allah hatama vakama, you lie to a Jew. It's part of their culture, unfortunately. Well, while all this is going on, I'm teaching, I'm lecturing, I'm writing, I'm doing. And then I took some of my lectures and I came up with a brainstorm. God privileged me. This little brainstorm, as you will see, has affected procedure in the Israeli army. And you've all seen it and heard it. and didn't understand it all came from a guy sitting behind the desk and a microphone in Gris Kollel. Now what am I talking about? The most difficult simon in the Shulchan Aruch, any Talmud Chacham will tell you this, is Simon Yud Zayin in Eben Esed. It's the longest simon. It deals with the classic Aguna. And what's so difficult about the classic Aguna is that we are being mater a woman to remarry, to have children. We're not afraid of mamzerut, and we're being mater the woman to marry on the basis of circumstantial evidence. Now just think. Any shaila we get, you get a shaila on Shabbos, can you use an automatic elevator? You get a shaila, can you go into a hotel and the door works with a magic eye, right? People walk in, it opens. No one walks in, it's closed. It's tangible, you can touch it. You get a shaila on a Frigidaire Shabbos. GE just announced they came up with a patent. Over 100 GE models, all you have to do is attach a certain box and it gives it a Shabbos mode. It's a tremendous invention. We have it here, of course, technological, but here it's built into the Frigidaire. What GE's come up with, you can take a Frigidaire, you already have it, it's one of these 100 different models, and you can attach it and put it into a Shabbos mode. It's tangible. You have a shaila with kashrut. Can you use whiskey, the caskets, the wine, all these shaila, it's tangible. Here you have a woman, 29 years of age. Her husband went to battle. He didn't return. Her husband was on a plane. The plane crashed. There are no bodies. The ship sank. And you're being mater the aguna on the basis of circumstantial evidence. All right, you have to be a lamdin mufak. And I know a book that just came out 2 years ago, Rakefer Aron Chelik Gimel. It's over 340 pages devoted to this very topic. You're familiar with it? All the sources are in there. The book is based upon the lectures that Rakefet gave in Gris Kollel. So it dawned upon me, Yonah is suffering. Money changed hands. Thousands of dollars to some mamza up north. Total lie. Idiots from India are writing emails to him. Rabbanim here, and I'll come to this later, are saying stupid things. Let's see if we can't solve the problem. And I suggested Mike Kaplan understood me immediately because he had learned a great deal in his youth. It took Yonah a little while to understand what I was saying. Let's take these three boys, Baumel, Feldman, Katz. Let's make believe they were married. And let's examine the evidence. Is there enough evidence lahatir et ha'aguna? Dov, are you with me? Make believe they're married. They didn't come back from battle. They left the wife who wants to remarry. Can we be matir the aguna to marry? Fascinating concept. Now, the truth of the matter is, to be matir and aguna to remarry, to declare someone dead, you don't need a beis din. You need a rav, a talmid chacham, someone who has his hand on the pulse, understands how to pasken. I just got a letter, don't want to go into more detail, complimenting, a nice compliment. I wrote back thanking the person very much because it's someone I hold to be a great Talmud Chacham. And he said in relation to my shurim, you have a good chush for psak. And I've often said that if I wouldn't have been a Rebbe, I would have become a Dayan. You have to have a chush. You have to know. It's not enough to be a Talmud Chacham. You have to understand how psak halacha works, halacha lamaisa. So you just need one person. But if you go through Rakefet sources, the Otsar Poskim, Minig Yisrael is that because Lahatir and Agunar is so important, so difficult, Mamzera, children, remarriage, adultery, you don't want to be wrong, you never do it alone. you always do it a Beit Din of three. All right, that's the procedure. Your father, your uncle would know very well what I'm talking about. That's the way it's done. So I suggested, let's form a Beit Din. That's everyone is talking about, the Beit Din. That's what the radio spoke about, that Rakefet, the Beit Din. You really don't need a Beit Din. But, and I have to tell you, 90% of the people who caught on and heard about what I did, and I'm talking within the army, within the rabbinate, they forget the whole concept of the Hatira Gudra, just the Beit Din. But okay, the idea caught on. Now, it was not simple. Why wasn't it simple? In order to do this, I made clear that we would need total access to all the information, meaning both the Mossad and the army's intelligence. Nothing could be withheld from the Beit Din. Yonah went to the chief of staff, proposed the idea. I don't even go into politics now. The prime minister at that time was someone whose name I mentioned a half hour ago, and he was involved in, it was a bad mistake that the info that had, the tanks moving forward were moving into a trap had not been passed on. Yonah was told, now's not the time to press this issue. There was an election, the government changed. The new prime minister and the chief of staff bought the idea. Now you have to form a Beit Din. Well, who's going to be on the Beit Din? I write it, but this is all in Washington, and this was on the Galei Tzahal, it was on the radio the other night, the other day. Who's on the Beit Din? Brigadier General Yisrael Weiss, chief rabbi at that time of the army. Who sat with him? Rabbi Avraham Avidan. Recognize the name? He had been a colonel in the army, in charge of halakha, tremendous Talmud Chacham. He became the Rosh Yeshiva of Shalavim. He took over for Rabbi Schlesinger. So we're now talking, this is the early 2000s, and he now is out of the army, but he certainly was acceptable as a colonel in the reserves to both the army and to anyone who's interested in halacha. The third person was, of course, Yonah Baumu made a tanai. It has to be yours truly. Now, in order to get involved, I needed security clearance of a much, much, much higher nature than the security clearance that Yitzchak and I had regarding Russia. So that took another few months, and I got the top security clearance. I still remember signing off that I'll never reveal any of the inner details. So, and everything I'm telling you now, nothing is a secret. This was all on the radio, this all is known. The inner details, I cannot reveal. But now, we went to work. And both Rabbis Weiss and Rabbi Avidan said, Anachnu somchim al harav Rakefet. Let him handle it. Both of them knew me. Rabbi Weiss knew me. His wife was friendly with my eldest daughter. There was a connection there. So he knew of me. His child had married, he was a machutin to someone in my son-in-law's shul, where I occasionally davened, the shul that my children ran, built up. My son-in-law's still running it on Rehov Palmach, the weekend shul. So there was a connection there. Rab Avidan knew me from my involvement with Yeshivat Shalavim. I played a certain role there. It's not important now to talk about it. But they were samach on me. By the early 2000s, I wasn't teaching as much as I was in the past. As a matter of fact, by that time, I had left Midrashit Moriah and I only was teaching in the Kollel. So one day a week, I would go to Tel Aviv in the Mater Klali, and I'd be secluded in a room, and anything I wanted was at my disposal. The army, the Mossad, totally, totally cooperated. Not only the information in print, not only the information that was available that you could look at, and there were thousands and thousands of pages of intelligence from anything that happened over the world, anyone that approached Jonah, the battle, the fallout from the battle, the Arab press, the video, anyone who I'm talking about, the movie, the bodies on the tank in Syria, Damascus, 1982. After all, they captured in this battle something like 8 tanks we left behind that were captured by the Syrians. Some of these tanks wound up in Russia in the war museum in Moscow, and these tanks were returned by Putin to Netanyahu, to the State of Israel. You saw one of the tanks, if you watched the news on television, they kept on showing the tank and tank again that had been Zach Baumel's tank, and that had been in the museum in Moscow. So all this, but it was more than just paper and information. The great experts on intelligence in this field totally recreated the battle, totally created the battlefield. Helicopters, Israeli helicopters, not hell, could be planes, because I don't think you can send a helicopter into Sultan Yaakov, it can be shot down. Planes took movies of the ground, of the battle. These movies, this was already with computerization, we're talking 18, 17 years ago, computerization, you relived the battle, you saw the ground, you were checking if there's any sign that the ground, they could tell if the ground had been moved, if there had been graves, if anyone had been buried, you have no idea. The pictures that appeared on Syrian TV of the bodies tied around the tank, you don't remember this? This was all over the world, it was just like a minute worth. 30 seconds, 45 seconds. We saw the movies, we enhanced the movies, we enlarged the movies. Are these people alive? Are these people dead? The strings we see, is it rope or are they tzitzit? Do you understand what went on, what we did, what we studied, what we went through? We relived the battle. We replayed the battle. You have no idea. Time and again, I would walk out. I was so depressed. You understand? You see what goes on. Because I have to tell you, I did basic training. And we told stories about Zach on Friday in the House of Mourning. And all right, basic training is basic training. But it's never like a real battle. This is why soldiers have shell shock. You can train for years. But in a battle, suddenly death and noise and bullets and guns and planes and bombs, no food, no water, a medic. You can't believe what a battle is like. I've been on battlefields. So it was so depressing. But we did our work. And here's the sad part. When all was over, and I'll go into the halacha in a moment, I concluded the boys were dead. I wrote a tshuva, the tshuva's on file with the army, that if these boys had been married, we could permit them halacha lemaisa, their widows, to remarry. I asked the army not to publicize my tshuva because I didn't want to hurt Yonah Bama. It's going to be a very difficult task to convince him these boys are dead. Rabbi Weiss immediately signed on to my tshuva. He was overjoyed. He spoke about it on the radio, by the way. And Rabbi Avidan said he would write a long tshuva and he could publish it. I refer you now to Rav Avidan Sefer, came out in 2006, Masa Bahar, carrying a stretcher up the hill. That's what it's referring to. Birurim chilchatiyim ben osei tzava bitachon ve'eretz Yisrael. And if you go to page 63, that's where the tshuva begins. It's a long tshuva. He tells the story of the battle, and this is very important. We relived this, we reacted it, we did it on the computer, we did everything. We set up everything like the battle is in front of our eyes. Within 15 to 20 minutes, there was endless shooting at the tanks as they fell into the trap. They were in the valley, the Syrians were on the hills on both sides. It was a tragedy, because there were 100 Israeli tanks not that far away that could have been called in, and we would have conquered them. And no one acted, no one knew. It's so sad. But that's war. You know how you begin. You don't know how it's going to end. Now, while the shooting was going on, and this is one of the other people, in every tank, there are four different people. One person is the commander of the tank, one person is the nahag, the driver, one person is in charge of kesha, of keeping communication with the central command, and one person is the one who does the shooting, who loads the gun and shoots, loads a cannon and shoots. The shooting is controlled by computers. Even at this point, computers played a big role. So one of the other people, Chezi Shai, heard Zvi Feldman say, quote, "Baumel is dead." Chezi Shai then told Lieberman, who is another person in the tank, and Shai and Lieberman are later captured. They return years later with a prisoner swap with Syria. Baumel is dead. Hainu, Chezi Shai, Baril, Lieberman, Me'idim, both of them testify. They called a number of times, "Zach, Zach," and there was no answer. Okay? Now, then there was other testimony. Chezi Shai and our Lieberman, who were in the same tank with Zach and Zvi Feldman, testified that after the fire stopped, the Syrians were convinced they had killed everyone, injured everyone. The tanks were now going to be captured, taken away. They take a look, and Feldman is very badly injured. Above his ear, they see a hole from a shell that entered his head, at least 7 to 10 centimeters wide, and he's profusely bleeding. All right? They then figured there's no hope. These two people are killed. Feldman is dead. Baumel is dead. They left the tank. They sought cover. The Syrians saw them and continued to shoot. But both of them escaped injury. One of them fell in front of a rock that protected him. And the other one was right behind Feldman's body, and Feldman's body protected him. They were captured, and as I said, many years later, they came back in a prisoner swap. Now, here you have testimony. Baumel is dead. You have testimony. Feldman is very seriously injured. Tell me, have you studied the sugya Yevamot? The sources are all in Rakafarar and Chelek Gimel, but it's a sugya Kufsayim, Yevamot, at the end of Yevamot. The last two prakim are filled with material on Heteraklana. Do you believe witnesses at a time of battle? See, there's a tremendous problem here. Can anyone give me the Gemara's rubric? Bididami. You think it happened. Bididami. I imagine, dimyon, from Lashon dimyon. Again, I repeat, You can train for years. When you're actually in the battle, it is helter-skelter. You have no idea what's going on. And you're only a human being. Let's say you're shooting and you're functioning, but right around you, all your best friends, your unit, have fallen, are injured, are dead, badly wounded. You follow me? How do you react? So can you really believe someone when he says, be the dummy in the middle of a battle, they are dead? Who saw the bodies? Who saw them dead? You may be imagining it. He was injured. Very interesting question. Okay? Zvi Feldman, the army brought in medical doctors who are experts in the field. And these doctors testified that anyone with a hole in their head this big who's not treated immediately has absolutely no chance of survival. So you see, in relation to Feldman and Baumol, there's pretty strong evidence that they did not come out of it alive. Two people yelled his name. Baumol didn't respond. Feldman has a hole in his head. No doctor is ever going to look at it, help him, clean it, clear it, operate, stitch it. Tremendous majority, even though it's a battlefield, the majority of people in this condition, in a battle, who are not responding, who have holes in their head, there's a chazaka, a rove, they are dead. And all of you know, media writer, when you have a rove, that answers the question. But the sugya and yavamit, because aguna is such a serious matter, Binyamin, one rove is not enough. And this is why for heter aguna, you always need a second majority, a second concept, a second sniff. All right? Tell me, how many of you have studied the writings of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spektovik? You are sitting here in Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. They just celebrated his yahrzeit, Chaf Aleph Adar. My Talmud, the president, Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman, gave a wonderful shiur. It's on, you can see it, it's online. Memory of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spekta. It's a nice tradition. Rabbi Belkin used to give a shiur in his yahrzeit. And Ari, and perhaps Rabbi Lamb, I don't know, I was not in the yeshiva when he was here. But Rabbi Berman now started it again. Elliot, what was Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spekta famous for? Was he famous for yeshiva in the earth? Didn't exist in his time. But five volumes, mainly of Heter Akuna. You want to read about it? A guy named Rakefet. Go to Rakefet Aaron, I think it's Chilik Bet or Chilik Aleph. It appeared in tradition on Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan's 100th yahrzeit, explaining he was called the father of the Agunot because he always was able to find a second concept, Lahatia. Chaim, Herbie, you know what that concept is all the time? I was just in Italy. One of the cities we drove through, and I think we actually shopped there, was found a store that was worth the whole trip just for that tremendous store. I got socks that I've been hunting for years. High, good, beautiful socks. It keeps you healthy. Verona. So in Verona, one of the last of the Balei Tosfos, Reb Yitzchak Meir Verdun. So there was a case there where a boat capsized and sunk. And on the boat were quite a few Jews. Bodies were never found. And Reb Yitzchak Meir Verona, it's in the Mordechai. All the sources, again, Rakefet Aaron, in the Mordechai. Whether it was three years, 7 years, variant readings, Reb Yitzchak Meir Verona said, So many years have gone by. They never contacted their wives. It is a sign that they are dead. And he introduced a new rubric of Vad Zichro, that if someone disappears and he doesn't surface, you forget about him, you can be Mata Diakona. Dove, the world went crazy. All the Rabbanim yelled and shouted against this concept. How can it be? Michael, what are we dealing with? America? America and Texas, whatever the... You don't show your face 3 years, she can remarry. I don't know, in New York, maybe it's 7 years. Maybe there's some states 10 years. But that's non-Jewish law. We have a concept, if he is alive, cheskat chayim. I last saw Chaim Yankel alive, it's 10 years later, chazaka, he's still alive. How can you come along? Avad zichro. All right. How many of you have watched Seinfeld? You know that expression? Put it in the safe. Put it in the vault. Lock it up. So you take the shita, which is a shita dechuya, wasn't accepted, but keep it around. Put it in the vault. Nowadays, whenever we have a shita like this, this always becomes the second rove. The first majority, the majority of people in the Twin Towers who didn't walk out are dead. Second majority, had he survived, and we know that he lived b'shalom with his wife. In other words, that's also, it's a Mishnah in Yevamah, shalom lo v'shalom la, that they don't throw dishes at each other. Nowadays, people get married, it's unbelievable, within a year, they're killing each other. Ribbono shel Olam, all right, but they're a good couple. They get along. Had he survived, he would have contacted his wife. That's always the second majority. It's called by the rubric of Avad Zichro. And nowadays, you don't have to wait 3 years, you don't have to wait 7 years. Nowadays, there's a telephone, there's a computer, there's email, there's a fax. Ribbono shel Olam, nowadays, 3 months is sufficient. If you know all the circumstances. No, Yitzchak. Does Avad Zichro apply here? What are you talking about? Baumel, Feldman, Katz, if they're alive, they're going to get near a telephone? They're going to get near a computer? They're going to get near a fax machine? They're going to be able to call, contact? But here's what we came up with. Listen carefully. What is in it for Syria? Why do they want, let's say they are alive, what's their advantage? Mikuach. Bargaining power. A modern Hebrew word. Mikuach. Mekach u'memka. This is an interesting word. Mikuach. Bargaining power. Hey, Israel, you want these boys back? We want 50 prisoners that you have of our spies, of our murderers, of our terrorists. Right or wrong? You want these boys back? 200, 1,000. We've paid off already with close to 1,000 to get back 2-3 individuals. Terrible outcry. I don't have to tell you what's gone on here in recent years. The fact that the Syrian government has never said a word about these prisoners is an absolute proof of Avad Zichro. They don't have them. You follow? It's the same concept, but in reverse. The fact that they can't call, that they can't correspond, but the government, if they're alive, there has to be a reason why Syria's not saying anything. Logically speaking, this is mikuach, bargaining power. You see what's going on with Hamas today, with dead bodies, how they won't return them, holding them, demanding for these two dead bodies, give us 1,000 living prisoners. So you see, you have a second majority here that can very well fit the concept of a Vad Zichro. With me, Yitzchak? Okay. There's more. I mean, this is a serious matter. You want to be Matir and Aguna? You got to be certain you're right. As certain as a mortal can be. All right, and here we come to something else. And here I can't I want to be brief. I can't reveal everything, obviously. But this raises the whole question of, and we spoke about this too, again, Rakafararim, Chilek Gimel, how much do you believe government officials? It's a very interesting question. Lo aleinu, World War II, endless Jewish homes got telegraphs from the war, from what's it called, the Defense Department in America. I don't think it's called the War Department, or was it called the war at that time? It was already called Defense. I don't know. But you got an official telegram that your son died in battle. Luke, can you believe the telegram? And this question comes up time and again. Obviously, the answer is, Rav Chochanan deals with it in great length, the Netziv deals with it. When the government has no reason to lie, you can believe an official document. It's based upon the whole concept in Kanshrit, Uman lo mare li umnato. A person, you have a factory, for the sake of argument, Heinz. How can you believe that the pork and beans and the regular vegetarian beans don't get mixed up? But Heinz, they can't afford a scandal like that. It would kill their business. You follow all the Jews and all the vegetarians and all the Arabs who buy Heinz with an OU. God forbid, a scandal like that would ruin the market. So you can be sure that when Heinz tells you this is kosher and this isn't, you can depend upon Heinz 99 or 100%. Absolutely. When the government has nothing to cover up, you can depend upon them. No, we contacted all these American senators, the American State Department, the Vice President of the United States. Everyone was happy to help Yonah. Everyone was happy to contact Syrian officials. And they all said, we have no prisoner, not Baumel, not Feldman, not Katz. Can you believe them? Of course not. They have an axe to grind. They want to find favor. Something will come up in the American Senate. They want to be able to say to the senator, we did you a favor and gave you an answer. We don't have these prisoners. Now you help us. This is not acceptable evidence because there's political interest, there's financial interest, there's many reasons why they may not tell the truth. But let me ask you something else. Nu, you've studied Yoredeya. What about a guy Meshiach Lefi Tumo? When a guy, you walk into the room, there's a piece of meat on the table. And one of the Gentiles who cleans here says, without you asking, he says, oh, that piece is kosher. It was just brought from a base burger ranch, whatever, one of the kosher burger places. They just thought it in the other, an hour ago for Torah Shraga. Do you believe the guy? Absolutely. Meseich Lafit Tumai is no axe to grind. He's telling you. It's not that you asked them. If you asked them already, that becomes a much greater sheila. Tell me, is this piece kosher? All right, then already it's not Meseich Lafit Tumai. But if it's Meseich Lafit Tumai, absolutely, you can believe him. All right? There was intelligence that we had from important people discussing the issue and mentioning, we don't have these boys. They're not alive. So now take a look. Can we be Mata the Agunat? You have the rove people who you think are dead in a battle, a person with a hole in his neck, with valid evidence that there's absolutely nothing that can be done now. If he had that hole and he wasn't treated immediately, absolutely dead. Medical evidence. We have some intelligence evidence of people who would know, and I'm mentioning it, Kaliachiyad, Meshechim Lefi Tumam. They have no idea that we're listening. Fabulous evidence. You believe them. And then you have Avad Zichro. If these people were alive, they would have used them for bargaining power. The fact that years have gone by and they haven't said a word, the greatest proof that they are dead. So in relation to Feldman and Baumel, absolutely we can be mater veragunat. The Katz case may be even sadder. And here I want to tell you that I have a direct connection to Katz. Among my best friends are Sue and Barry Lieberman. Yitzchak knows them. Sue is a cousin to Katz. It's Hungarian families. They're interconnected. I think it's a second cousin. I don't think it's a first cousin. I think it's a second cousin. The Katz boy was ashamed of her. He was, you have to understand, in the tank crew, Baumel was a Hezda boy from the Gush. Feldman was not a Hezda boy. He was just a regular soldier in Shiryon who happened to be in the crew of that tank. I know on TV when you see the Feldman family, his sister appears with a tichel, not a hair showing. She's a balachuva. The family parents survivors, more traditional than strictly observant, but a good part of the family today is totally observant. So he was in the tank. The other tank where Yaakov Katz, Yehuda Katz was, he was a Kerem B'Yavna boy, tremendous Talmud Chacham, tremendous Matpid. Yoni used to say about Zach, I don't know how much time he spent in the Beis Medrash, but I can tell you he was out there on the basketball court daily. And he was, they say he was a tremendous basketball player. That's what I heard Friday. Yehuda Katz, before he went into battle, he gave Divrei Chizuk. What an individual. Now, his tank was hit by a missile at a very early stage. And here, both people in the tank, two of the other three, both of them, after the shooting stopped for a few minutes, went back into the tank to look for the Katz boy. And they saw that he was dead. The mafaked of the tank actually held his pulse, tried to give him artificial respiration. Nothing helped. And then, after the other two escaped and ultimately came back to our forces and were not taken into captivity, the tank was hit again by a missile. And the tank burned and burned and burned. I don't have to go further. Chas v'chalila, there may be very little left of anything and anyone who was in the tank. This is why when relations between Israel and Russia warmed up years ago already, the Russians allowed us to search the tanks they had from the battle in Moscow, and we worked very diligently to see if in the tanks there were remains from the fire that could be identified. We dead-ended, but there's no question that Lahatir, the widow, as if to speak, of the cat's boy, would be infinitely easier than being Lahatir, the widow, of the two others. There already, there was testimony, he was dead. Bididami would not apply, because if you know the Sugan Yavamat, if he says he was killed in battle, the Kofatir, and I buried him, there already you may very well believe the other soldier, and I buried him. It's not just guesswork. Here, they actually felt his pulse. They felt the body. They tried to do artificial respiration. They were convinced he was dead. I need not tell you, if a tank burns and burns for hours, no one is going to walk out of that alive. And of course, the concept of mikuach, why didn't they mention they have the body, they have the person, shows you avad zichro. And therefore, HaRav Avraham Avidah signs off the tshuva lahalacha l'cho hamur le'el klini chotein b'tza amok ki al pi halacha shloshad hanechadarim mikerev Sultan Yaakov Tzvi Feldman, Zechaya Baumel, Yehuda Katz, Einan Chayim Tiyena nishmot kedoshim eila tzvirot Bitzra HaChayim, and he signs off, Aluf Mishneh Miloim, HaRav Avraham Avidan. Now, because of my deep feelings for Yonah, when you read Washington, you'll notice I don't tell you the outcome of what we did, but I refer you to Rav Avidan's Psak with the source. So that way I tell you our outcome was they are dead, but you want to hear the details, pick up Masa Bahar and read the tshuva.
What year did that come out?
It's the book came out in about 2006, Masa Bahar. Let me just see, yeah, 2006.
Why was Yonah Baumol so convinced that he was alive?
Well, that's what I spoke about. That people were contacting him. They heard people speaking Hebrew in jail. We spoke about that an hour ago. You can pick it up. It was very sad. Now, what happened is very interesting. The army was ready to announce that the three boys are maklanim, maklan. It's Rashi Tevet. Makom kavurato lo noda. Mem kuf lamed nun. Here, the Katz family, more than anyone, but I have to say Yonah as well, the Feldman family was more parav. They didn't take an aggressive stand. The Katz family went, and I'll mention the name, and I'm not happy about this, but he was a great Gaon, a great tzaddik, part of my family, my brother's family, great devotees, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, the Sfadik chief rabbi. The Katz family went to him, where is our son? And Rav Mordechai Eliyahu answered, he is learning Gemara at this very moment. Now, how do you interpret this answer? Mm-hmm. So Yoni came to me and said, yeah, he's learning Gemara in heaven, in the Beit Nishalmala. They interpreted it that he's learning Gemara down on earth. And they went to Bagatz, demanding that the army be stopped from declaring these boys dead. I have to tell you, the Bagatz, they're supposed to have seichel, they're judges on the Supreme Court. Sometimes they do have seichel, and sometimes it's very sad. It's obvious to anyone who has a mind of Torah, learning, knowledge, scholarship, they are lacking. And here the Bagatz met, and I got a tzav to appear before them. I was in America, how could I come? No, Rakefet played such a crucial role. Wait till he gets back. Wait. No, they gave a ruling, I quote, nothing has changed, and therefore the army cannot announce that these boys are dead. This has tremendous implications on many, many different levels, from social, financial, moral, ethical. Couldn't declare them dead. Nothing has changed. A great deal has changed. The idea, lahatir aguna, I could have presented it, I could have explained it, but the Bagatz ruled what they ruled. Rabbi Weiss claimed on Galei Tzahal that Yonah threatened to sue him for millions of dollars if he would announce that they're dead. I don't know. I don't recall Yonah threatening to sue, but okay, they did go to Bagatz, and Bagatz ruled what it ruled. However, the army realized that in all future events, lo aleinu, of this nature, they have to follow the Rakefet policy. They use the word, we establish a Beit Din, it's become the magic word. They don't realize where it comes from, and no one would understand, 90% of the people, who's Alamdin, Mufak, who knows the Sugyas in Yevamot, who knows Shimon Yud Zayin Ibn Ezra. So if you notice in subsequent matters, including the last war, these two boys who were taken, their bodies removed, the army immediately investigated. One of them actually risked his life. We know the person Fund of Forest Hills origins. I knew his grandparents. I know his parents. Fabulous young man. I hope he's still in the army, rising higher and higher in rank. Risked his life to check what's with the body? What do we have? Alive? Dead? If you notice, after a proper investigation, the military rabbinate declared them dead, and these boys, the most famous name is Golden, whose parents are fighting the prime minister today, were declared maklanim, makom kvuratam lo nota. They didn't wait 10, 20, 30, 37 years. But last Wednesday, with all the pain and all the heartache, I have to say, I felt good on one level that my conclusion was not incorrect. And part of the feeling good, let me go further, is that now we know the boys did not suffer. They were killed in battle. We worried all along, if they're alive, where are they? How much have they been tortured? Miriam Baumer said, we quoted it in our publications, in our fundraising for ICMIS, I don't know whether my son has food, whether he has a blanket, the cold in a Syrian prison. We worried. And now we know in retrospect, yes, it's horrible, it's terrible, but war is war. And as the Gemara, Ein milchama b'li kavanot, Ein kravot b'li kavanot. Look into the Netziv in Chumash, two places, in Parshat Noach, and then again in Sefer Devarim, where he deals with battle and murder and killing. At least we know they were not tortured. They did not suffer beyond the moment of death. So on that level, I felt, Baruch Hashem, We didn't do wrong. No, Kalani had nothing to do. No, that Kalani is the hero of 73. This is 82. You're confusing the eras. Yeah, I want to. Right. One second. Let me just. I want to end off with some Divrei Torah. It hurts. Should say something in their memory. Baruch Atah Adonai Melech Olam Shekel Mi'Avid Barom. We don't really understand the Russians. All I can tell you is in the House of Mourning, there were some very important people there. I told them we owe all this to Chabad. So they looked at me like I'm crazy. You know, look, I explained myself. When I'm finished explaining, suddenly my status goes up. Putin grew up in Leningrad. Yitzchak, you and I remember when we were in Russia under the communists. Families shared an apartment. That's how poor the communist empire was. They could send up Sputnik and scare the heck out of all of us. You remember how scared we were in 57? But they were impoverished. It was a Potemkin's village. So I saw with my own eyes in Leningrad, here's a Jewish bedroom, here's a Goyisha bedroom, here's their one bathroom, and here's their one kitchen. Go and keep kosher. You share a kitchen with a guy. The future prime minister, czar, whatever you want to call him, Vladimir Putin, shared an apartment with a Jewish family, Ehrlich. He became very close to the family. They were Chabadnikim. They were Shomer Torah and Mitzvot. And at night she would ask, Mrs. Ehrlich, did you eat supper? No, his parents were real communists. They worked till 9 o'clock for the party. They came home and they said, come eat with us 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. Friday night he would eat with them. He knew what Kiddush was. He knew what Gemara was. Mr. Ehrlich was his wrestling coach in high school. Now, if you know Putin, he's a wrestler. And he loved, at Ehrlich's funeral, Putin was crying. There were eyewitnesses to it. That's one influence. Another influence in this one, I told him, everyone popped up. Do you remember when Putin was here? They asked him at the press conference the day he was here for 3 days. The day he left, why did you buy an apartment for this woman in Tel Aviv? In South Tel Aviv, there was a woman, Minna Berliner. And he went to visit her. And he was very unhappy with Eva. And he bought her a beautiful apartment in North Tel Aviv. The Russian government paid for it. She died. You know who she left the year? She died a year ago. She left the apartment to Putin. Putin has an apartment in North Tel Aviv. So they asked him, what is this woman to you? And he said, if not for this woman, I would be a gangster today. With his third grade teacher. I found out when I was back in Russia a year and a half ago that she never married. She was a very devoted teacher. She came from a well-known Chabad family, Dore Doret of Chabad. So you see, they left an impact on him. It's unbelievable. What we saw, the miracles, what we saw the other night, the other day, the television, we can't believe it. Can't believe it. We, you and I, more than anyone else in this room, because we saw these same uniforms with a pachad. And remember marching up and down in the Kremlin, in Red Square. The honor guard. Gotta believe.
So they had the bodies, or they knew
it? We don't know. We don't know. That I can't answer, because the real story, how the bodies got to Russia, who examined them, how they got the tzitzit. All right, Putin would call Rav Lazar. It's no big deal to show it to Lazar. Tell me, what is this rabbi? That's his rabbi. You know what I'm talking about, the head of Chabad. He built the museum. Putin's name is listed there as one of the big contributors. He gave a full month's salary, told them to give it to the museum. I don't need it. Give it to the museum. So they explained it to him. All right, the Israeli press at first said the talus, they got a talus. It was an abacanthus. How could it survive 37 years? We don't know. The story is beyond words. It's not human. It's kashkacha pratit that breathes down your back. So I want to say two concepts on the Seder. I've said this. I said it in YU last year, and it hit home. I heard from the Rav, the first concept the Rav said over from the Balei Musa, it's not a Brisker concept, it's a Musa concept. Leil HaSeder, you're going to reach the Suda, so the first thing you do, you make a bracha and matzah. Everyone in this room does it that way. No, Herbie, you made a bracha and matzah. What's the matter with you? Your chronological calendar is off. The Murah came before the matzah. Right or wrong? It's a good question. But the Balei Musa said so beautifully, to go on living, you have to have a certain defense mechanism. You don't have it. You know, from the survivors of the Holocaust, 90% were like Herbie. But 10%, some are still in mental institutions until today. You with me, Herbie? In Israel, you know. No, some are. Yeah, I said 90% survived like you, Baruch Hashem. You got to be strong. But how did Herbie do it? I'll tell Herbie how he did it. Because he had a defense mechanism in him that he blocked out the negative, the evil, the bad. And he stressed the beauty of life. He stressed the positive. He got to America. He went to a day school. Knew it. Knew your parents. Positive. Ah, Chazal were very smart. We want you to be healthy. We want you to be mentally capable, balanced properly. Human nature, remember the matzah. You came out. You redeemed yourself. We're free. And then we say, but wait a minute, now we got to be honest. There was a lot of difficulty, a lot of negative, a lot of concepts, experiences that were bad. Got to remember that too. But only after the matzah. Then we pause, and then we can go back to the korach and go on to the meal. So I want to say, it was magnificent. The funeral, the covert, who would believe, if only Yonah were here, if only Mike Kaplan were here, on every newspaper, front page, Zach's picture, the people who spoke at the funeral, everyone spoke so beautifully. Whoever wrote Netanyahu's speech was a genius. An absolute genius. I couldn't. The president's speech, and you got to give him credit. His wife is critically ill. Spoke so beautifully. The chief of staff, the Baumel family, the children. Wow, what good, what matzah. But unfortunately, the Murah is very bitter. And ultimately, we're Jews. This is our destiny. This is Hakeidat Yitzchak. David Hartman attacked the Rav, that the Rav felt Akedat Yitzchak was the most important pasha in the Torah, and Hartman felt it's the worst. Pardon me, Hartman didn't know how to touch up a patzer kumish in his old age. The Rav was absolutely right. We have that ability to live with Korach, to balance it properly, and to go further. And then I want to go one step further. It's a meridikvot from the Rav. Take a look at Hallel. Every time you say Hallel, you don't interrupt. Who's allowed to interrupt her in Hallel? Leil HaSeder, you say two prakim of Hallel, eat a tremendous meal. And then after the benching and the afikaimen and all that went with it, you finish up the Hallel. Why? Why? And the Rav said, this is a Jewish concept, a Torah concept. It's the heart of our existence. We don't have the secular and the profane. For us, all of our existence is holy. Everything we do beyond Torah learning, davening, Yigand, every mitzvah, everything we do in life is sanctified, has a purpose. And this is what the Seder is trying to teach us, that the Hallel is interrupted. It's not really interrupted. It's one continuity, one song of expression of life before God. Even when we eat, we drink, our so-called non-holy activities are also in service of the Almighty. And here it comes back to what we've spoken about in class, in the Monday class, Torum Derech Eretz. What is the ultimate? What is the basis? Is it only Torah? Is it Torah with Derech Eretz? And in the state of Israel, we don't have to ask this question, because all our Derech Eretz is one tremendous mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz. And this is what Yitzchak asked, to bring this about, to be able to give the tshuva I just gave, intelligence, computers, planes, spy ability, DNA, establish the bodies, politics, international relations. Wow, I just gave a long list. Someone might think these are secular activities. Chas v'chalila. These are activities that enable Medinat Yisrael to thrive. And this is all part of Torum Derech Eretz before God Almighty, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. What a mitzvah. And wow, when we eat the matzah, it's not an interruption. It's a continuation. It's part and parcel of the Hallel. Hold off, Yitzchak, just let me...
Because the first two are praise and the last are...
What are you trying to say?
That there's two different themes.
The first two are praise.
And the last are requests.
But there's also... Wait one second. But there's also plenty of praise. Hodu Lashem Kitov, Ani Nibani Shalaylam. All right. I like the Rav's answer. That's a different answer for a different time. So the Rav contradicted. It didn't contradict himself. Supplemented himself. That's why all these philosophers who raised the contradictions, you know my approach, they don't realize the Rav, in Halakha you can question if the Rav contradicts. Beyond that, he was reacting to the audience the moment. Let me reiterate. Yoma, will you please tell Rob about the shir so that he gets the right topic and they may want to publicize it. People over the world should know what's going on. All right. I nibandel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is a great schut to be part of this story. I have to admit that I never had any intention of speaking about it, but when they spoke about me in Galei Tzahal, and everyone wanted to hear the inside story, I said, all right, that's it. I can't repeat the story 50 times over, and even my grandchildren will be listening to YUTorah.org. So what did we do today? We explained Halacha L'maisa, if they had been married, how we would treat the agunat, and I believe we're on very firm, solid, halachic ground. Ani modeh HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that last Wednesday, and still, we can't believe it, those of us that were so intimately involved, it was like Maimir HaSinai, like the heavens opened, that my grandson was screaming at us. Now this grandson is the eldest of my middle daughters, my eldest grandson, and he's the eldest child, and he knew, he was already of age to understand everything his mother was doing in the 1990s into the 2000s. And he, just when he called, it was like the world was opening for us, like thunder, lightning coming down from heaven. And with all the heartache, we rejoice in the matzah, but we cry with the bitterness of the Mara. But what can we do? Akedat Yitzchak, and a Jew has to know how to eat the Korech throughout his existence. Ani modala Kadosh Baruch Hu that we're in the state of Israel, and the little kid from the Bronx, I wind up working for the Mossad, dealing with the Israeli army, mi milel umi pilel. And I have to end off in thanking the Ribbono Shel Olam that my grandfather remained in America. If you've read Washington, all of you know that my grandfather was very lonely. He saved up enough money. He was not married yet. He was a teenager. And he purchased a return ticket to Russia. And right before he was going to sail, he got a telegram from his parents. Don't come back. Fanya, which means the Tsar, has drafted you for the Russian army. They were then about to fight the Russo-Japanese War. So, ani modeh l'hakadosh baruch hu. Let's give out. First of all, Fiyomo, here's a little article on the Ukraine. And anyone who Putin doesn't like, he just blows them away. And Yomo, you're lucky you're here, not there. Here is the new president. This is from the commentator. The new president of Yeshiva, what do they call it? The Yeshiva University Student Organization, whatever it's called. Here is the new president. Take a look and read the article. Unbelievable. Here's if you come from New York, they're no longer going to give out bags in the supermarket, just like Israel. You can blow your brain out. And if you come into Manhattan with your car, you're going to be taxed. They're going to have cameras set up, and anyone going beneath 60th Street has to pay through the nose. Here is a Jew who died at the age of 86, Sidney Verba, and he is a scholar of democracies. How to compare democracies. Very fascinating what this man invented. Here's another copy of the article I gave out on Monday. Lo aleinu, it's in the news today. If you heard the news, it was the leading item. Who's meeting with Netanyahu? The people want, they're not males, they're not females, they're both, they're neither, they're transvestite. Oh, God have mercy. This is a new thing in New York. You have a bat mitzvah and bar mitzvah together because the person hasn't decided whether he's a male or female. Here's another one about New York. The Jewish councilman, Kalman Yeager, who said that there's no such thing as a Palestinian state, was just kicked off every committee, and the Blasio malediction, and Ribbono Shel Olam, all I can say is, it's like a Korach sandwich, bitter, but it's great for Aliyah. Boy, if anyone has any seichel, get out while you can, because America is now like 1933 in some other country I knew of. And this, my dear Yomo, is for Chaim. Be'ezrat Hashem, tomorrow we pick up right where we left off with Rabbi Dr. Leo Young and his activities on the Palestinian-Israeli scene. I don't know if we'll reach it tomorrow. We will deal with Joe Kamenetsky, Yeshiva College, 1932, and I'm bringing in a relic that in any museum, the crowds will be lined up to see it, and Rakefet will pull it out in front of your eyes right in this classroom. I want to thank everyone for coming. I want to send my regards to all the people listening across the wide expanse of the Jewish universe. And until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya. Okay.